People over pixels. Thank you. People over pixels. And we've asked a volunteer to share the opening reading for this topic.
Bob?
Do you mind coming up here?
Hey, everybody. My name is Bob. I'm a sexaholic.
Hey, Bob.
People over pixels. From the White Book, page 157 to 163. Lust only yields to the slow, patient working of the program in the context of others who are doing the same. This is one reason we need the fellowship of sobriety on a continuing basis. The rewards are unending, giving us the true freedom we always wanted. How I overcame my obsession with lust. How did I do it? I didn't. Woman in AA told me after she spoke in a meeting, quoting chapter 5 in Alcoholics Anonymous, that God could and would if he were sought. And that's how I did it, by letting God do it, because I couldn't. But God could and would and did. But I had to go to the meetings to learn things just like that. Meetings. That's what they told me. Keep bringing the body. Work the steps. Going to meetings and working the steps. That's how I did it. That's how I learned to let the grace of God enter to expel the obsession. Here's what worked for me. One, stop practicing the compulsion. I stopped acting out in any form, any and all forms, including sex with myself and non-marital relationships. There could be no relief from obsession of lust while still practicing the acts of lust. Two, stop feeding the obsession. This meant eliminating from what was under my control all printed and visual materials and other symbols of my tyranny. I had to stop feeding my lust by looking around in my use of television, movies, and music, and by using and listening to the language of lust. I also had to stop living only and always inside my head. That's one of the great fringe benefits of going to a lot of meetings. Most of us sexaholics really live on the inside of our heads. We're seldom in the real world. Three, participate in the fellowship of the program. I don't know if anyone could stay, who can stay sober and free of the obsession of lust without such fellowship. I couldn't. Fellowship is where the action is, where the magic is, where connection is, where feeling part of is. At first, all I could do was attend meetings. Then I followed the suggestion of getting involved in the mechanics of the meetings, setting up, cleaning up, holding jobs such as literature chairman, treasurer, or secretary. Getting involved made me feel I could be a part of instead of apart from my old nemesis. Later, I'd be able to go out for coffee, start meeting with another's one-on-one, and begin the painful but necessary process of growing up by coming out. 10, learn to give instead of take. This technique works on lust too. Whenever I'd catch a likely image in the corner of my eye, instead of obeying the impulse to look and drink, I keep looking straight ahead or praying for that person. It might be simple, God bless her and give her what she needs. Or depending on the intensity of the lust stimulus, it might be more fervent, God bless her and make her a blessing. Thy will be done in her life. I began doing the same for models in ads that had a similar power over me. Whenever I do this kind of thing, I feel good. I get something back that is clean and strong and free and good. I somehow became a channel for releasing good into me instead of opening up a conduit of lust for evil to come in. The measure I drink in of that image is the measure I am enslaved by it. The measure I give out to another is the measure I am released from its power. Please, it's so much easier to give. Plus, it's so much easier to give than to try that old self-mortification kind of willpower. Try it sometime. You cannot lust after one if you're praying for in such a manner. Here's an experience related by a woman member. I remember early in sobriety seeing a very suggestive video in a department store. I got drawn in, and before I knew it, what hit me, the image took me over. So I started praying for that singer over and over, and it worked. I've tried many times since, and it always works for me. This action also may also serve to make indirect amends to all the anonymous objects of my lust and sex acts. Those many strangers I have helped confirm in their destructive way of life. It seems to be a law of the universe. The measure I give is the measure I get back. 11, get an SA sponsor. I need someone who could see me better than I could, even though he might have had some of the same problems of his own. Everyone I used as a sponsor had imperfections big enough to turn me away if I wanted such an excuse. It was my reaching out and taking direction that worked. I made regular contact and followed directions. It helped me make me teachable and saved me a lot of grief and lost time. 12, made friends in the program. My sexaholism had forced me away from true intimacy. I'd become a loner and a love cripple. To recover, I had to begin coming out of isolation and connect with people, but I didn't know how. At first, I was forced to make phone calls to stay sober. Then, as I shared with others in my distress and they shared their trials with me, a common bond developed. Partners in sobriety, what a boon. It helped change that lonely, gray inner world of the separated self into the bright sunlight of glad times shared together. Victory over lust was not the grim experience I had feared. I was getting connected to life, and I began to feel impulses of joy. I was beginning to have what my lust had really been looking for. I can't have the inner freedom from the need to lust without this real connection. 13, carry the message of your recovery. At first, I began by guardedly talking about my sexual obsession and desire for recovery to those who gave hints of similar problems. I didn't know this was part of working the 12th step. I was doing it because I wanted to. Then I started sharing the truth of my experience in other meetings I was going to. Very few ever responded, but the point is, it was helping me. Bill W. of AA used to say that 12-step work takes a little money and a lot of time. And I found that being willing to spend a fraction of my time and money on carrying the message of my recovery that I had spent on my habit to keep me sober, when I give freely of my time and means in this manner, I get back the priceless gifts of freedom from lust, plus joy and serenity. In the process, I've also taken the first faltering steps of learning how to love another human being. I couldn't ask for a bigger payoff. Thanks.
Thanks, Bob. For the next few minutes, I will share my experience, strength, and hope as it relates to the topic, after which my co-leader will also share. When we finish sharing, the meeting will be open for others to share. May I ask a timer to please time me and my co-leader for 3 minutes each? Thank you.
Thanks.
So I'm Bradley, a gratefully recovering sexaholic.
Hey, Bradley.
When I was looking at different meetings and such, this one just caught my eye. I know for me, you know, I grew up with print pornography first. but man, when we got to video, you know, it became a real, I don't know, the insatiability. And then of course, when we got on the computer and the internet, pornography, you know, it was just a locked me in, and you know, life became even more unmanageable, which progressed. But all those images, you know, of women, you know, these pixelations, and whether it's on a page or whether it's on a video, whether it's on the internet and such, you know, just this false, this fantasy image, was so powerful, you know, was such a big drug for me, but I was so disconnected from real life, so disconnected from, you know, my wives, two marriages, that ended in divorce, partly a lot because of my addiction, because I was so much focused on spending time with that fantasy rather than spending time with a real person and connecting with them. And a lot of that comes from just being emotionally stunted. I can look back now and see that, you know, around the age of 14, I was sexually abused by an older brother starting from probably around age, might have been as early as age 10, but definitely age 12, and exposed to pornography at that time. But then when I got to 14, my father had an affair with a secretary, excuse me, and moved out of the house for, you know, a number of months. And that just, you know, that was a big wound in my heart. My father was a sex addict himself, so having Playboy magazines around, it was, you know, I picked up on the fact that this is important. You know, this is what you want, you know. And yeah, it affected me, and I basically got stunted from that point going forward in terms of emotional maturity, in terms of understanding what is intimacy, what is, you know, how do you communicate, you know? I didn't have the ability to have that kind of intimacy in relationship, but grateful I do now, but that's some of my experience. Thank you.
Thanks, Bradley.
Hi, I'm Tim, grateful recovering sexaholic. I also love the topic, people over pixels, and I started objectifying pixels very early. In fact, actually, I got introduced to pixels very early on. I was hooked, and it wasn't necessarily pixels of women or anything like that. At first, it was just pixels. I was like, okay, I love this, and started working with computers and things like that early on. After I'd been introduced to pornography at a much earlier age, so it was printed stuff, and then getting into that when I was in 12 and 13 is when I got into the computer pixelated stuff a lot more. And I was hooked. I became very obsessed just with that. And when back in the day when I was doing that, it's like they had digital bulletin boards and things like that that you had to wait a very, very long time in order to download anything. And I was addicted to the intrigue, the tease, the forbidden, and something that may or may not actually show up on my screen in an hour and a half. And so that was pretty bad. I was like, okay, I'm addicted to this stuff. In fact, actually, when I started working on staying sober from lust and realizing that I was also addicted to computer games and everything else, I was like, oh boy, I've got a problem. The nice thing is as I worked the steps and started learning how to surrender, I could surrender, use the same methodology for all of it. And that's what I liked. It's like whenever I got the temptation to objectify or go back, I could just pray and let it go. And I would pray and let it go and pray and let it go and pray and let it go and pray and let it go. And I don't know, it just seemed like thousands and thousands of prayers going up, which was good for me because one thing I knew I needed was to practice constant prayer. So constant surrender is one of the things. And now today, it's just so wonderful to not be driven and obsessed with that process. In fact, actually, the amazing thing is when my wife now, she'll do something that I thought was humanly impossible. It's called start a show and watch it for 10 minutes and then shut it off and not come back for a couple weeks and then start from that 10 minutes and watch another 10 minutes. And I'm like, that's insane. It's like, how do you do that? And the cool thing is I can do that now. In other words, I don't care. In other words, it's no longer that obsession of things. And also the nice thing is the content that my wife likes is some of the stuff that I generally fall asleep in. So I'm grateful. I'm grateful today to no longer be obsessed with pixels, and I prefer people. I'm preferred connection. And so with that, I'll take another 24 and we'll turn it over to the group.
All right, thank you. This meeting is now open for sharing. So as many as possible can share. Please keep your shares to the time limit of the 3 minutes. We ask that sharing be pertinent to the topic. We don't take the inventories of others. That is, we uncover and work on our own defects, not those of others. We avoid politics, religious dogma, and other divisive issues. We avoid explicit sexual descriptions and sexually disrespectful and abusive language. If someone feels a share is too explicit, they may signify by raising their hand. We do lead with our weakness and take the risk of total self-disclosure. Please raise your hand, introduce yourself by your first name before sharing. The meeting is now open. Please come up to the microphone if you're ready to come up and share. Yeah, and if you want to line up, it's fine too, but or just come up. Thanks.
Good evening slash afternoon, everyone. My name is Nick. I'm a sexaholic. Yeah. Definitely a pornaholic, too. I saw this topic, and I knew this is where I'm supposed to be. I'm sure a lot of our stories are similar. Finding porn stash, finding pornography at a young age, being immediately glued to it. I share that same story. I don't know what kind of got me intrigued before the pornography, but I've done some stuff in my step one, which, of course, I don't have time to share my step one. But so anyways, ever since that moment I saw pornography, the videos, and just all the unmanageability came with that for years and years and years. And I just have to admit today, I don't know why today of all days, but I miss pornography today. I really do. I have to be honest with that. There's just a part of me that just really misses that today. But the wonderful thing is I didn't really want to do it. Like, I even had thoughts of leaving today. Like, I want to go home and do this thing and like watch and somehow get this thing. And I went over to the gardens and just had some quiet time and just reflected. And just like, there is hope and there is tools of the program. But it doesn't mean it's easy. It doesn't mean that you're not going to miss this thing, because I do. And it's just, I know I'm an addict today. I've had questions with that. But I know today, because of all the shares and all the unmanageability, I can resonate with all of that today. But specifically with the pornography, places, situations, I have been numb my whole life. I know I'm in a family, but never was a part of that family. Was always waiting to act out. Was always I just didn't really care about life. I had other addictions too, but just the pornography was just something that's has such a tie to my heart, and it still does. And it's just hard to let go. But I've seen the progress and I've seen some hope. So just today, I just wanted to share that it doesn't, lust and pornography and the will to do that or wanting to do that doesn't, it doesn't have a time. It doesn't have a place. It's just, I can kind of laugh now-ish about that. I'm at a Unity conference and my mind wants to go to watching porn and going home and isolating. So, I just needed to do that, needed to share, needed to get up here first, or else I might have just crept and not said anything. So, Nick, sexaholic, thank you guys for letting me share, and grateful to be here. Thank you.
Thanks, Nick.
Mike, sexaholic.
Hey, Mike.
Yeah, I can remember the days when my addiction started. I, too, was dealing with magazines, pictures, and things like that, then videos, and then, of course, the internet exploded, and every time the new development occurred, the dopamine receptors or whatever dopamine comes from in my brain would just explode. It was something new, it was something different, and it would just keep pulling me back. And, I ended up being discovered by my wife, who discovered some of the places I had been visiting online. Didn't know about all the places I was visiting in person, but she found out this stuff online, kicked me out of the house. And I got into the program, but one of the things I've come to realize is that for me, and probably, I got into the program about 2005, about 10 years later, I discovered a new avenue, erotic literature. So now the issue with literature and stories and fantasies is it creates images, and maybe not pixels, but images in my mind. And the problem with fantasy for me is that those stories are there. You know, I can sort of vaguely remember the institutions I used to go to and do things at. Haven't been there now for 20 years. So that sort of has faded, and I'm sure if I began, it would be just as powerful as it was. The internet is still powerful, but if I've pretty well, I've gotten to where I can block and shut that down and stay away and work on that. But I carry my brain with me, my mind, wherever I go. And that's where so many of these videos continue to replay. I call it my hamster wheel thinking, because it all does takes a very small start. And then the hamster wheel, the pixels, the images, they just keep going and going faster and faster. And one of the things my sponsor has encouraged me to try to do is he says, and I think we see it in our literature somewhere, the sexaholic lives inside their mind for so much of the time. And part of what I am trying to practice or learn how to do is to bring my mind into the present moment and start naming things that I see around me, naming the color that things have, naming the feel of the whatever it is. But the few times I have tried it, it actually has been successful in terms of dissolving, at least for the moment, dissolving that hamster wheel thinking about that fantasy that's in my mind playing away. Because my addict just wants to find what it will take for me to dump more dopamine in there. So anyway, that's just something that I struggle with. So my pixels are inside my head, but one of the things I'm trying to learn to do is to just sort of bring myself back to the present moment and train my brain to be looking at what's really happening around me. And when I do that, it seems like it does dissolve the hamster wheel. So anyway, grateful to be here, grateful for all the shares, and thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, Mike.
Christian sexaholic. Yeah, grateful to be here. Thank you guys for the shares. Yeah, really interesting. I mean, as people were sharing, I recall like the first time my neighbor, his name was Junior, he brought over a porn magazine, right? And it was like this woman and police officer thing. And it's really interesting, but like how things get ingrained in my brain, at least at a young age. And I went on to date a lot of blondes, right? And this woman in the magazine was a blonde. And I think there might be some direct correlation there. But, you know, finding magazines, the cable. And I think what's interesting about it is like a lot of that actually probably came from like the hunt, right? The addictive personality, the hunt of finding these things, the secrecy associated with it, right? And tracing back to just how I grew up in a household that didn't really talk about feelings, emotions, everything was like, keep this from this person. So I learned how to hide and lie. And I think it directly, that skill set directly complemented it with porn and my disease. I think, you know, and at one point, like 6 months into this journey, I acted out with this woman, I relapsed. And then I had like 67 videos where I turned myself into a porn star. And I just remember thinking when I was getting sober and getting back, like, I mean, I acted out for like 2 months. That's a lot of videos. That's not normal behavior, you know? And so it just, thinking back to it, one of the things that was most difficult was getting rid of a lot of those things, right? Like Pandora's box, right? Videos and secret, all these things. But I think the miracle, right, or the blessing of having a relationship with God and coming into the program is I don't have any urge anymore. I don't have thoughts about it, like, at all. It's completely gone. And I'm super grateful for that, for somebody who I didn't realize, like, how destructive it was and how it separated me, not only from the person that I was with at the time, right, keeping me in fantasy, but also from God, right? It was like my own rebellion and moving away from him. He was always trying to be there, but he can't be in that. And so I would consciously separate and remove myself from him. But it's really beautiful to see, like, today that, you know, he's lifted that obsession of those thoughts or the secrecy, and the closer I am to him and the more connected I am with real relationships, the less I have that pull and that urge. So thank you, guys.
Thanks.
Hi, my name is Craig. I'm a sexaholic.
Hey, Craig.
Hi. You know, when I saw this, saw the title, I immediately thought of how I, you know, it's just so easy for me to go to a Zoom meeting, and because it's easier for me to get distracted, or, you know, it's harder for me to pay attention. And how, you know, well, before COVID, I was going to all these face-to-face, you know, in person, we used to call them meetings, and how I know I need to get to more real life, you know, real meetings. But it's, you know, it's just so convenient to go to Teams and, you know, I could, or whatever your platform is, and, you know, I can just, you know, sit there in my pajamas and, you know, scroll the news while someone yaps away, and I don't even, hardly paying attention. It's hardly recovery. So thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, Craig. That's great.
Does it move?
It's fine where it is. You'll get it. It'll hear you.
Okay. Tom, sexaholic.
Tom.
I saw that word pixel, and I had to think about it for a minute. What is that? My old days would say pictures. And so I guess most of you figured out what pixel was. I can remember really, really young. I grew up in upstate New York, and the snow would be gone in the summer, and they'd have these outside magazines. And so I was drawn to those right away. And I remember looking at some of those. And, you know, I had a roommate in San Diego. We had some semi-pornography. And that's when I first started looked at that. And then as it progressed, as it usually does for us, I found magazines. I remember I was in Alaska, and I found some good magazines. And I guess I was a little weird of going around where I lived and doing it, but I did. And so I had all kinds of magazines, you know. Then I bought a VCR, if any of you are old enough to know what that is. Some of you probably never even saw one. Anyway, I knew what was going to happen right away. I went to the video stores, and that was kind of weird. Didn't know who you were going to bump into there, you know. A lot of people knew me because I was a teacher. And, and so I didn't know if my students were in there or their parents. And so I'd get the videos, and, you know, I got all strung out on those. And I guess I'm blessed that I got sober before I got a computer and before I got an iPhone. It must be so much more difficult now because it's right and so easy. I had to work. I had to go and get embarrassed, like, and buy the videos and stuff of the thing. And I didn't know who saw me come out of the porno shop, you know. And they had that little secret part of that. I don't even know if they sell those anymore. Who's got them? But there was a little special part for the real sex addicts, you know, just the regular movies for everybody else. But I didn't know who was checking me out or who I was giving the money to. And so it was weird. And then when I bought, same thing when I bought magazines, you know. And so what I did with the magazines, I would get, I'll take them all, put them in a suitcase, put them under the cupboard. Or I was really crazy and throw them out. And, you know, like, why do that? You know you're going to go buy more. And so when I got to SA, their suggestion was get rid of everything that you can, you know, that would be associated with your addiction. So I took all my videos, and I didn't want to put them in the dumpster where I lived in case my neighbors saw them. So I went up and down the beach and dumped them in little different dumpsters. And, so somebody got some good stuff if they saw me. And I even went to the point of is there a bell? Okay, one quick one. I also went through all my magazine, all my picture albums, and if I couldn't show them to mom, they came out. So I've had these picture albums with little blanks here and there because I took stuff out that I couldn't show mom. Thanks. God bless.
Thanks. James Sexaholic. Hey, James. I may have picked up some of those magazines sprinkled around, but I was in Northern California. It was some NorCal sexaholic who threw his stash away. I'd ride around on my bike and go, I know what's in that box, and I'd open it up and dig through it, take the ones I wanted, put it in my backpack, and ride home. So whoever had missing magazines who went to retrieve it after they threw it away now knows where it ended up. But I came of age in that era where it went rapidly from magazines to cable TV to internet to cell phones in a span of like 10, 15 years. And like a previous share, I had to get on the latest technology for all of that. And I recently got a new phone and was fortunate enough to do that and have the desire to keep this one clean. I don't want to make it dirty. I don't want it to be a dirty device. Like every other piece of electronics I've ever owned has had junk on it, and it's been soiled. And this one I want to keep clean. I don't want to go anywhere on it. I don't want to see anything on it. I don't want to pull anything up on it. And I actually use it as a phone. And I call people with it. And that's what I mostly do. I'm texting other brothers. I'm calling my sponsor, and I'm calling other people, and I'm taking calls, and I'm like, man, this is the most I've actually used a cell phone as a phone in like forever. And so I want to keep this one clean. I want to keep my sobriety up. I want to keep using it as a tool of recovery, to look up meetings, to look up people I can call, to, you know, look up fellows' addresses when I want to go hang out. And I want to keep it that way. So I want to keep this going, keep my sobriety up, keep my phone clean, and with that, I'll pass. Thanks.
Thanks, James.
Hey, everybody, I'm Scott. I'm a recovering sexaholic. Grateful to be here. Thank you, guys. Thanks for the shares before me. And just thinking about the topic, you know, it's when I look back at kind of just like what was shared generationally, it just seems like it was so much harder in the past, you know? It's like started off with finding stuff that my father had hidden around the house and kind of stealing that or whatever. But then, you know, the progression, as with everything, always came down to, well, what was the next thing? And even when I was in, like, I mean, it's hard enough to, like, steal all these things because I couldn't go buy them or whatever and have to find them around the house. Then I was one of those guys that had to like watch on the little TV, and through the squiggly lines, I had to be able to see the porn. So it's kind of like, and I, when I went to college, man, I could be there for like hours trying to sort out what was really going on because I couldn't pay for the service to actually see what was going on. And then one day I remember somebody talking about how this idea of the computer and like everything would be on there. And then you got to get on the computer and wait all this time for it to download. And I mean, it's like everything was difficult. And now look at how easy it is. But the one thing that I would say about all of that, no matter what the mechanism was, for me, it was all about isolation. When I look back at it, all the things that I did were always in isolating by myself, not wanting to see myself, not wanting to be with myself. And so I always looked for a way to isolate, be alone, and go to this drug of choice, right? And so, you know, there's this thing of the opposite of addiction is connection, right? So I always say the greatest thing I ever got from coming into this program, even though I didn't come willingly and I got sent here by a CSAT therapist, the greatest thing I ever got was a connection with a higher power, okay? Because that I never had, and I didn't have a spiritual way of living. But the next best thing that I got as a result of this program and being in this program was connection with real human beings. And I never had that. And this is the first place in my life where I've ever told men that I've loved them. I've ever gone to breakfast with men individually. And it's the only place I've ever really felt comfortable. And still to this day, even when I'm isolated, I try to, if nothing else, remove myself from that situation. But the connection piece is what gives me more tools. It allows me to call people. It allows me to do things. I can get on a meeting. There's a lot of things that I could do. In isolation, I didn't want to do any of that. I just want to go to the drug and just be able to numb out. And so the program is a real blessing. It gives me so much more than I could ever really give back, and I'm just grateful for that. It's grateful to hear everybody and see everybody here. So I'm Scott. I'm a sexaholic.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks, Scott.
Michael, I'm a sexaholic.
Hey, Michael.
And for me, my addiction started as a kid, and seeing a little girl, we were curious about, oh, how do you pee, how do I pee, and that kind of stuff. So the pixelation thing didn't start right away, except in my head. Once I saw it, I wanted to always see it again, and I didn't get that chance for like years. So when a friend showed me pornography, adults at that point, I was intrigued. And still, because it was early on, like everybody else is talking, it was difficult for me to get to that. I didn't want to go and buy a magazine. I would just go and look at it in the store and that type of thing. But when I'd go on a trip after marriage and going on a work trip, I would find that I could go on to television shows and, the X-rated stuff that I couldn't see at home, but I could see when I'm out traveling. So that was an issue. But of course now with the phones, and I can see whatever I want. But what I wanted to talk about when I first saw the title was I was imagining you were talking about the pixelation of just vegging out. And I find that that's an issue for me. I can, if I get on just a social media, just Facebook, and just looking at Facebook for hours on end, just scrolling, that's a danger for me. I'm not looking at anything pornographic. I'm just vegging out, and that makes me susceptible. You know, if I'm in a strong place, I can go over those, oh, that's a little critical. That's a little one that's a concern. I should skip that picture, and I will. But if I'm not in that strength position, I will click on it, and then I can go down the road and end up going for the pornography and everything else. So I need to be careful of any pixelation, social media, or whatever. So thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, Michael.
I'm Rich, a lustaholic.
Hi, Rich.
I remember back in the days of the hunt and going behind the barn and doing it, it added a certain amount of intrigue, which made the experience that much more susceptible to addiction. But when it got really easy with the computer, that was different. I remember we used to have the blocks on the computer. I assigned myself the purveyor to go and make sure these blocks worked. And of course, I'd find a way through them. And I, of course, report it to the block company. Hey, this isn't working. And of course, my reward was I had to check to see what got through. Anyway, that didn't lead to a whole lot of sobriety. Anyway, the whole thing, you know, the other problem is I always had a really good memory. So, you know, I could conjure stuff up in my head. I really didn't need magazines. I didn't want to pay for them anyway, or go through the embarrassment of having to buy them. But it's crazy. But what I did realize that when I'd get 3-4 months of sobriety, the pictures would blur. They wouldn't be as, I couldn't rely so much on my memory. So basically that was a big key to getting lots of sobriety as I went along. But the whole idea of it is, it's crazy. The kids, what they're seeing today is some pretty raunchy stuff, and they have complete access to it. So for that reason, it doesn't have that mysterious thing that we had to go through way back when. But on the other hand, it's, you know, the kids are thinking nothing of acting out in ways that we wouldn't even think is a big deal. I mean, one of the things I've noticed in counseling men is, and kids, or younger men, I should say, men and guys in their 20s or 30s think nothing of crossing the line with a cross-dresser or transvestite or whatever you want to call them, transsexual, because and they don't realize. I mean, once you cross that line and become bisexual, you've opened a whole can of worms. I mean, I've counseled lots of men that just have a hard time, if they've crossed that line, staying sober, because it's so much easier. But and I blame that on pixels and pornography on the internet, basically, because everybody's getting such a laxed thing about it, and with all the, you know, it's okay to be this way, you know, it's drives me nuts. But anyway, thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, Rich.
I'm Michael. I'm a sexaholic. I'm very grateful to be here at this conference, and I'm grateful to my sponsor and his sponsor for driving down with me. It's good to get a whole other perspective from different people with different backgrounds. All Caucasian males, but still different backgrounds. It's funny, you know, this is the first meeting where people have come up and gone back to their seat, like, very consistently. The other meetings I've been in, it's been kind of slow, a lot of pauses. And I think it's just because sexaholics like talking about porn, you know? It's just fun. Even in recovery, talking about how we used to do it still has that a little bit of that allure, you know? But, you know, I can say for me, like, I was absolutely obsessed with fantasy when I was a kid. I would say I didn't, like, feel an emotion until I was 18 and I went to college, because I was extremely repressed. And, you know, having a bad childhood or a tough childhood is not a necessary condition to be a sexaholic. Anyone can be a sexaholic. You can have an amazing childhood, and then you just find the lust when you're 25 and you're down the road. But for me, it was a very difficult childhood, and I was lost in fantasy at all times. Music, movies, TV shows, fantasies in my head that I conjured up, food, sexual and romantic lust, girls, women, however old I was, you know, that's what I was into. And pornography, of course. I had a tremendously crippling pornography addiction. But it's just that idea of, like, for me, it's different for everyone, but for me, it's like, I don't want to be in my body, in my mind, in my spirit. I want to be somewhere else, but I don't know how to get there, so I'm just going to escape. And it's very powerful, and it's very scary. My hope is to gain recovery through continued working of the steps and communing with other men in recovery, and I'm very grateful for everyone here and for my sponsor again. Thank you. Thanks, Mike.
I'm Brandon. I'm a recovering sexaholic. What's a VCR? I stole that joke from Nick, by the way. Nick told me that joke, just want to be very clear. But yeah, my story with discovering acting out, it did start online. And I do think it is a different beast, because, I mean, I didn't even look it up. It just popped up on my screen, and then the rabbit hole started. And when it comes to my addiction to it, it's it really progressed very, very quickly. There was no delay in whatever I wanted. I had access to it at all times, and progressively worse forms of it over time whenever I wanted, to the point where, you know, I was doing it as easily as you would text someone in public, in front of family, in front of friends, just out and about, wherever I possibly could. I was just consuming it to then build up the anticipation of maybe potentially acting out on it later on. And all that exposure to it, and when we talk about people over pixels, what I've been thinking about as I've been listening to all the shares is, with all the amount of acting out I did growing up, I really wonder how that has impacted my ability to actually connect with people. I haven't done any great digging into it, but something I have realized over the past couple months is that I really struggle with genuinely loving people. Even my family, there's of course a love for them, but I think there's really a deeper fear of appeasement and fear of ensuring I do the right things to make sure that they love me. And of course the objects of the acting out and what I saw and people I saw in public, I don't see them as people at all. I sit here and I don't even see a problem with that. There's nothing inside me that thinks that that's an issue. But I intellectually, I know that's a bad issue. I don't even see the people on the screens or the people I see in public as people. And when I talk to my family, I'm more concerned about, I'm less concerned about making sure they know that I love them. I'm more concerned about, okay, how do I make sure you don't get upset at me? How do I make sure that I appease you and make you happy, and that I can go out and do what I want? I'm not sure what pornography and acting out has contributed to that, but I'm pretty sure it probably has contributed to that. And I think part of my hope here is that in the maybe year and a half, two years I've been in the program, I've realized that there is another side to this addiction. There is another path through all of this where I can one day rely on my gut, and I acknowledge time. I can see people for who they are. I can love all of you people in here, my family. I can love them genuinely, and I can do it all through the help of my higher power. And I'm helpless against doing it. I don't want to do it, but I know that through God, I can do it. So that's a great hope for me. But thanks for letting me share. I'm Brent. I'm a sexaholic.
Steve P., recovering sexaholic, and thank you. Wow, I've identified just about everything here, guys. And I acted out 18 years, 10,000 times, mostly. And for me, before I got to SA, it was porn chops, you know. And I'd drive 5 freeways, like an hour and a half, you know, and to get to my favorite one out in Pomona out there, you know. And I remember, you know, you go in there, and the guy behind the counter, I guess you got this lascivious, wild look in your eyes, you know, when you're trying to get your change. And the guy would give me this dirty look, you know, anyway. And it feel great, you know, the cheap thrills, you know, for about, you know, a few seconds of fun. But then you got to crawl out of there like a snake, you know. I mean, and I remember I was up north, and I was hanging out in front of this one downtown Seattle, you know, and I saw this guy walk out of there, you know, and he was like, you know, he had this look on his face anyway, you know, like he, very guilty look on his face. Anyway, but yeah, and I would, you know, I, one time I went to this liquor store after I acted out, and there was this big black cop standing there right in front of me, you know, and he looks, turns around and goes, "Hey, man, what's your problem?" Because I guess I radiated all this, you know, psychotic negative shit or something coming out of my pores. Anyway, and then it really stunk in those places. I mean, really bad, you know, before they cleaned them, you know, they get the bleach on it. It's dark, you know, and you keep punching that button, you know, to get the, you know, the right movie, you know, and half an hour later, you're still Anyway, I don't know. And I was hooked. I mean, I was so hooked on it. I mean, anyway, but horror stories. But anyway, I have to have a filter on my phone. Even though I know somebody says, you know, the filter's in your head, you know, but I know. Like, I told this guy, it's covenant eyes, and he goes, what, with covenant ass? And I go, no. He thinks it's funny, but I can't trust myself, you know, when I'm alone, you know, with that, Anyway, but thank God for this program, you know, that I'm a porn head, but I'm a recovering, you know. Somebody said, you know, oh, you're a porn head, you know, and I go, I don't like that term very much, but anyway, thanks for listening.
Steve.
I don't know. All this talk about what it's like in porn shops, I mean, it brings back a lot of, yeah, not so pleasant memories. And I, oh, yeah, my name's Gabe. I'm a sexaholic. Yeah, I know. I'm addicted to the unreal. I really am. And I remember as a teenager going into the, you know, that section, you had to go through the beads or open some shuttered door, and it made all this noise, and you just thought like everybody saw you walking in there. Once you're in there, it's like nobody's looking at each other. You know, you're just kind of like, is this the one? You know, is this the one? That might be the one. Maybe this is the one. I'd spend hours, you know, just looking for that perfect picture, you know, the one, the ultimate whatever, you know, it was. And that's what I did. I remember I had my favorites, and I had driven out far away to see somebody in real person. It was one of those, you know, performers. And I'm sitting there, you know, in strip club, and there they are, or there's, you know, it comes out, and I'm looking, I'm like, wow, she looks angry. She doesn't look like the box. You know, it was something different. But anyway, pictures. You know, we all have our best pictures, say social media or whatever. You know, I met my wife online, and she had a couple pictures on there, and, you know, modest, and I really liked them. And remember, we were meeting for our first date, and I'm walking this way, and you know, it was her coming across the street, but I'm trying not to, you know, I'm like looking, okay, is that her, you know, I wasn't sure, you know, I was like, okay, because I'm resorting back to this picture in my head of, you know, what I, you know, and then, you know, so I kept walking by her, and, you know, so I was like, I better call. And, you know, and so sure enough, it was her. She answered the phone. Oh, that was you. Oh, okay. And but she later said to me, she goes, yeah, I think when we first met, you weren't that impressed with me. And, you know, that was like, yeah, I'm just like a, you know, a pixel junkie, I guess, because I was thinking of the pictures. And but anyway, in contrast to being sober and, you know, seeing my wife, and, you know, I just sometimes I feel like there's a beauty there that, you know, being married and going through, you know, the whole thing, like, you know, getting married and seeing my wife, my real wife, you know, not a picture of her. And it's a beautiful thing to be able to see somebody as they really are, and see a beauty that, you know, that I think, you know, only like a husband can see in his wife. And so, yeah, I don't know. Can anybody relate to that? Or, I mean, yeah, you're addicted to the pixel, and now you're seeing the real thing. Thanks, thank God for it.
All right, that's all the time we have for sharing. Thank you for sharing. If you do not have a chance to share, please find someone after the meeting to talk with. This is an anonymous program. Please keep all the names, shares you have heard in this meeting to yourselves. Our experience teaches us that attending meetings, working the steps, and giving and receiving sponsorship are the key elements to maintaining our own sobriety. Would anyone willing to sponsor or temporary sponsor please raise your hand? All right, thank you.
Please note, ID badges with the blue dot indicate those willing to sponsor or attempt sponsor. This is an anonymous program. Please keep the name, email, address, and phone number of anyone you meet or learn about in SA to yourself. What we say here, let it stay here. All right. I've asked a volunteer to read the closing reading. Thank you, Mike.
Mike Sexaholic. For February 26th, Freedom from Lust. Since we had something to do with becoming what we are, we can assume responsibility for the change of attitude, surrender, that will allow healing to begin. Essay, page 57. I used to be an obsessive girl watcher. On entering a restaurant, I would scan the room for the most attractive woman and then position myself to look at her. At sporting events, cheerleaders and female spectators usually received more of my attention than the players did. My wife, angry and humiliated by my behavior, demanded I get help for my obsession. A therapist pointed me to SA, and it was here that I learned my obsession is rooted in lust. The images I took in fueled my world of sexual fantasy. My escape to that lustful world was driving a wedge between me and my wife, daughters, and female co-workers. I was clueless until SA helped me realize I am powerless over lust. My obsession was ruining my relationships. Gradually, I became sober, worked the steps, and found support in the fellowship. I surrendered my lust to my higher power and began to change my attitude toward women. I learned to respect them as persons and no longer viewed them as sex objects for my pleasure. When that changed, my relationships with all women began to heal. By God's grace, I can live today free from the bondage of lust. God, thank you for releasing me from the bondage of lust. Help me treat each woman I encounter today with dignity and respect.
Thank you, Mike. After a moment of silence for the sexaholic who still suffers, please join me in the third step prayer, and we'll do it in a circle.
Third step prayer. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Keep coming back, it works, if you work it, and you're worth it, so work it. Dang it.